Blog Talk Radio.
We own this country. We own it. And it's not you owning it and not politicians owning it. Politicians are employees of ours. And they're just going to come around and beg for votes every few years, and it's the same old deal. But I just think that it's important that you realize that whether you're Democrat or whether you're a Republican or whether you're Libertarian or whatever, when somebody does not do the job, we got to let them go.
When your entire culture is under attack, you need the country's number one voice in defense of our American way of life. You need an ally in the fight against tyranny and corruption. You need your weekly dose of Lisa Payne Nager. Missouri Grassroots Radio Network proudly adds our own beauty to America the Beautiful, your own culture vigilante, Ms. Lisa Payne Nager.
Welcome, this is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. And on Wednesday evenings, this is your Culture Vigilante Hour, and over the past year, we've been coming to you on Wednesday evenings at 7 o'clock, and we're thrilled that you took the time to spend your evening after Christmas, during your Christmas vacation with us. It's December 26, 2012. And as we look upon the new year, we're looking back at some of the things that we've been able to bring you at Missouri Grassroots Coalition through our radio programming throughout the last year. We've had some great interviews here on the Culture Vigilante Hour since May when we started our programming. And tonight we want to bring you three of those great interviews for you to listen to again as you're all celebrating your holiday season with your family and your loved ones and your friends. And we also look forward to bringing you some great new programming in 2013. We want to tell you a little bit about what we've got planned for the coming year. In 2013, we're going to expand our Tuesday evenings again with Cynthia Davis and Cindy McKee from Show Me Patriots. And we know that those two ladies are very informed and engaged in the political process here in Missouri, and they'll both bring their unique outlook on what's going on here in the state, and hopefully they'll help you become more informed and engaged in the process and get you motivated to get out there and make some changes that we all know need to be changed here in the Missouri legislature and the culture in general. And on Monday evening, we'll continue with Dave Court, Hour of Truth. Every Monday evening at 7 o'clock, Dave will be here giving you his unique libertarian spin on the culture and how he sees things in the legislature. And on Wednesday evenings, we'll be here every Wednesday at 7, doing our Culture Vigilante thing here with a variety of guests the way we have all through 2012. And on Thursday evenings, Kevin Harney will be here with Hillbilly Logic. Kevin's been a great addition to the Missouri Grassroots Coalition programming, and he brings some incredible guests and some great information to the mix as well. And throughout the year, we're going to be working to expand our programming into Fridays and Saturdays as well, so please keep your ear to the ground for that. We'll keep you posted as updates are developed. Tonight we have a replay of three great interviews that you've heard here on Culture Vigilante throughout the year. I've been very blessed to have some wonderful people join in the programming here and help give us some information about the various issues that affect Missourians across the state and across the country. Our first interview tonight will be with Bill Federer. Bill Federer is a fantastic historian and a great American, and he knows more about the history of of America and what's gone on over in the Middle East than just about anybody that you can talk to. He's an author, and he's run for office before. He's just an amazing man. He's multidimensional, and he's just a wonderful guest here on Culture Vigilante. He's been on a couple of times, and tonight we want to replay that first interview with him. Actually the second interview that we had with him just a few weeks ago was probably the most well-outlined and informational process about what's been going on over in Benghazi that I've ever heard anybody explain, and it's so coherent and so well-organized, and I wanted to replay that for you tonight. Welcome back. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is your Culture Vigilante Hour, and we are back with us, as we've promised. We have Bill Federer with us tonight to talk a little bit more about the Benghazi issue and to give us some of his insight. Bill's probably got more information stored in his head on the Middle East and the culture there and all of the details that go along with it than anybody on Earth. Thanks for being with us tonight, Bill.
Lisa, great to be with you.
So
We've all been watching with great interest the issues of just prior to the election and post-election, the issues of Benghazi. Just appalled at how things have taken place there. Can you give us a little bit of insight? You and I have conversed by email a little bit earlier this week. You kind of feel that some of this Benghazi issue is kind of a fast and furious deja vu.
Well, it does have some instances that look like a Saul Alinsky, Karl Marx, Machiavelli type of strategy. What do I mean by that? Our founders, I wrote a book, it's called Change to Chains, and it's a 6,000-year quest for global control. So I go through the very beginnings of recorded human civilization, about 3,000 or 4,000 BC, are when the first human records were ever written down. Egyptian hieroglyphics, Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley. Well, from that time till now, about 6,000 years, there's been dictatorships. That is the most common form of government in world history. Sort of a default setting for human government is dictatorship. You get a bunch of people around, and one of them winds up being the bully. And so we call them different names, pharaohs, caesars, kaisers, sultans, czars. What is rare in history is people getting a chance to rule themselves without a king. Israel under the judges, but the rubber band snaps back, and they decide they want a king. Athens had a democracy for a couple hundred years till they were conquered by Alexander the Great's dad. Rome was a republic until Julius Caesar made himself dictator for life, and the rubber band snapped back. And I go through all these instances till we come up with King George III. Now, the British Empire was the most powerful empire that planet Earth had seen, 13 million square miles, a half a billion people. They eventually had all of India, which is a quarter of the world's population. But America's founders wanted to do the opposite. They did not like the king appointing all the judges, and they decided that he was right and they were wrong. They didn't like him blockading their harbors and siding the natives of the frontiers. In other words, they wanted to go to the other extreme. So they took the power of a king and separated it into three branches, separated federal to state level, and then tied up this new federal Frankenstein with 10 handcuffs. All our Constitution really is a bunch of hurdles to prevent power from reconcentrating back into the hands of a dictator. That's the gravitational pull. And we're like the satellite up in space, and every now and then we have a booster revival to try to keep our freedoms independent. But this gravity wants to pull power to Washington. It wants to concentrate power. And again, this has happened over 6,000 years. And so there's a whole set of philosophers that talk about how do you take separated power and reconcentrate it. And the reason I go into that is because you can understand the president's actions when you see it from this point of view. 500 years ago in Italy. Now, Italy was not Italy 500 years ago. It's a bunch of city-states. Venice, Genoa, Naples, Florence, Siena, they all had armies and navies and fought. And there was a guy named Machiavelli, and he thought if one prince could control all of the Italian city-states, there would stop this infighting and it would be peaceful. So he figured his end was so good that any means necessary to get there is justified. So he wrote a book called The Prince, where he advocated the end justifies the means. The end of one prince controlling all of Italy is such a good end that you can do anything you want to get there. So lie, cheat, steal. So here's a scenario. The prince wants to conquer a city. The city does not want to be conquered. They would hate the prince. But if this prince pays criminals to kill cows, burn barns, and create crisis and terror, the people would cry out for help. The prince would come in and kill the very criminals that he bribed. Nobody would know the better for it, and they would praise the prince as a hero. So it's good marketing. You create the need and fill it. You go around the back of the house and set it on fire, and then you go around the front of the house and solve a fire extinguisher. And they'll pay anything for it and thank you for being there. So it's called Machiavellianism, where you create or capitalize on a crisis to consolidate control.
Oh, my God.
This has been going on for 500 years, and everybody in politics, like Rahm Emanuel, never let a good crisis go to waste. Bill Clinton used to quote Machiavelli, Anyway, Machiavelli inspired someone named Hegel. George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel lived in Germany in the 1820s. He has a special impact on Missouri. You think, what? Well, in Germany, after Napoleon invaded, the Prussian response was that we need to have a strong state to keep Napoleon and any future dictator out. And so it devolved into this idea that the state is all important. And, you know, King Frederick of Prussia got, you know, Hegel and these different guys to come. And so they came up with this idea that that the state is all-powerful. Hegel said, it's called rationalism, nothing's real unless it's provable, and he could not prove God, so he said God's not real, and he said if there is no God, that there is no eternal life, and he said the closest you can come to eternal life is to create something that will exist after you're dead. You know, so like the Greek idea of building a statue, and if they remember you, well, that's at least better than nothing, but that's the closest you can come. And so Hegel said that instead, rather than a statue, he says the best thing you can create is a government. And so he said the highest purpose of humanity is to create and perpetuate big government. So this state worship is your highest purpose in life is to serve the state. You exist for the state's benefit. Now we know in Prussia that turned into the Weimar Republic, that turned into the Nazi Germany, that turned into that state worship. But during this early 1820s period, a bunch of German immigrants came to America, came to Missouri, and Missouri became a state. And what did Missouri choose as its state motto? We are the show me state. Nothing's real unless it's provable. This is Hegelian dialectics. I mean, Hegelian rationalism. If you get a Funken Wagnalls encyclopedia and you look up Hegel, it'll say Hegelianism, the St. Louis movement. So a bunch of these German immigrants were coming over and said, nothing's real unless it's provable. Hegel came up with a theory called dialectics, Hegelian dialectics. And it sounds complicated, but it's not. It's a triangle. One corner is a thesis. The opposite corner is an antithesis or antithesis. And the top corner is a synthesis. And so you start off at the thesis, the first corner, and you create the antithesis. You create the opposite. And then, so in other words, you create a problem that's real bad, and then everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad, the synthesis. And so Hegelianism is basically you create real bad problems, and everybody's happy to settle for the answer that's half as bad. And so this influenced Karl Marx, and Karl Marx applied Hegelian dialectics to politics. And he said, okay, how do you change governments? He says, well, you send community organizers and labor organizers into a country to create an antithesis, to create a crisis. And he said, how do you do it? Well, you find the have-nots. You find the people that feel slighted, that they're left out of the political process, they are poor, they're down on their luck, and you play upon their lust. And you say, you want what the other ones have, follow me, you'll get it. And it works best if the people are not religious. I mean, even Napoleon said religion is what keeps the poor from murdering the rich. So if you can get rid of religion, then these people are just can be ruled by their passions. So you go to a bunch of these poor, unintelligent people and say, look, you want what they have, follow me, you'll get it. And then you stir them into riots and crisis. And when there's blood in the streets and neighbors are being killed, everybody is happy to have the order restored, and they don't care if there's a dictator that does it. And so 45 countries fell to communism this way. They would send in their labor organizers and community organizers, and they would organize the proletariat against the bourgeois, which is the working class against the business owners. They'd organize the poor against the rich, the Muslims against the Christians, the Hutus against the Tutsis in the Congo, you know, the Catholics against the Protestants. They really did not care who the two sides were or what the issues were. Their goal was to destabilize the system, to bring it down, to create a crisis. And then in the confusion and the killing, everybody's happy for this synthesis. They're happy for somebody to restore some kind of order. But in the process, they've just given up their freedoms into the hands of a dictator. And so, again, 45 countries fell to communism this way, and communism is nothing more than dictatorship. Every communist country has a communist dictator: Stalin, Pol Pot, Ho Chi Minh, Castro, Kim Jong-il, Putin, whoever you want to call. And so we see that this Machiavelli, this Hegel, this Karl Marx influenced Lenin. Lenin said, well, what you do to create this crisis, he says, you have to grind the middle class out of existence through the two millstones of taxation and inflation. So you tax them, and then what they've hidden away, you inflate the currency, so what they have stashed is now worthless, and then you take over. Stalin said crises are necessary for the government to demand and obtain total submission of all citizens. I mean, Stalin was so bad. There was a he wanted another crisis so that he can consolidate more power. And there was a Tea Party movement starting in the Soviet Union. It was called the Anti-Stalinists. And he was scratching his head thinking, how can I get rid of these anti-Stalinists? And then he had an idea. Stalin had a supporter named Sergei Kirov, who loved Stalin and would give these great speeches praising Stalin as the liberator of the workers of the world. But he was getting a little bit too popular, and so Stalin had an idea. He would assassinate his friend, Sergei Kirov, and blame it on the anti-Stalinists. Everybody would suspect him because they're buddies. The anti-Stalinists didn't like him to begin with, so everybody would say, oh yeah, they... And so he used that as an excuse to kill millions. So Stalin had to create crises. Even Castro said that the revolution needs for its development the antithesis, the people starting the crisis. Anyway, this influenced someone named Saul Alinsky. Now, Saul Alinsky was a community organizer in Chicago. He apprenticed by driving around with Al Capone's hitmen. He was really impressed that all you'd need to do is a little terror and crisis in a neighborhood, and the whole neighborhood would fold and submit to the gang and, you know, would pay them their protection money and so forth. And so Saul Alinsky decided to apply this to politics. And he said a community organizer's job is to create the issues. Community organizers seek out problems rather than avoiding them. He must rub raw the resentments of the community to the point of overt expression. The community organizer must fan the flames of hostility. He must seek out controversy, because unless there is controversy, the people are not motivated enough to act. And so Hillary Clinton wrote her master's thesis on Saul Alinsky, and our current president taught Saul Alinsky's community organizing tactics when he was in Chicago. And when he was working for Acorn, and how Acorn would go into the offices of the banks and force them to lend money to poor neighborhoods and bring the banks down. And then the banks said, well, what do we do? And then the federal government decided, well, we'll buy those worthless loans. And then so that caused basically the whole subprime mortgage crisis. But this idea... So we have a president who is a master at creating and capitalizing on crisis to consolidate control. A matter of fact, his campaign manager is David Axelrod, who said on NPR Radio, April 2010, he said, in Chicago politics, we have a tradition where you throw a brick through your own campaign office window and then call a press conference to accuse your opponent. In other words, you create the crisis, and then you blame it on the other guy. In other words, you tank the economy on purpose, and then you blame it on the rich people. And so I use the idea of fast and furious. Now, if people are not familiar with that, this is a situation where our attorney general is held in contempt of Congress. In other words, he should be in jail right now for contempt of Congress. Why is our Attorney General, Eric Holder, held in contempt of Congress? It's called fast and furious. This is where evidence has shown that our government was supplying guns to the drug gangs in Mexico. Now, why would they do that? Well, they wanted to create a crisis that involved American guns. And so they could come along and say, gee, there's crisis with American guns. Somehow these drug gangs are getting American guns. We need to register and limit American guns. Somebody in our country's giving them to them. We need to shut down these gun trade shows and these gun shops and these stores. We need to do this. And so they needed a crisis with which to achieve their agenda, which is taking away the Second Amendment. And now we look at Benghazi. And the evidence has been coming out that the president not only knew about it, but was not allowing protection for our U.S. ambassador after requests for protection, and was transferring troops and protection out and leaving him totally vulnerable. And then there was a drone that was circling, watching all this happening. And, you know, you wonder, gee, was the president aware of this? And then immediately after the killing of our ambassador, the White House sends messages to Google saying, censor all anti-Islamic content. And then the president gets on and gives a dozen speeches saying, it must be this anti-Islamic video. And then Hillary Clinton gives speeches. It's this anti-Islamic video. And then she buys, you know, only 0.5% of people in Benghazi even have access to the Internet. And only, you know, just a couple percentage of people in the whole country of Libya have access to the Internet. So clearly it was not the Internet. And here's Susan Rice, who's being, you know, interviewed before the Senate for a hearing, and finds out that it was described that she was there in Africa when they bombed our other embassies, I think in Tanzania and some other country, and how this had all the exact symptoms that the other ones had, and how come she was asking for more defense for those embassies and she didn't for this one. And there's lots of questions that look like somebody who's really inept, unless you look at it from the Machiavelli, Hegelian, Saul Alinsky, Karl Marx type of strategy. Now, who has the president surrounded himself with? Who has he put on his staff? People that have been ingrained in this concept. So, now, why would they want to have this crisis and blame it on this person insulting Islam? Well, lo and behold, a year ago, Hillary Clinton had been meeting with the 57 Muslim countries in the UN, and they were wanting her to sign on to an anti-blasphemy law that would prohibit all the members of the UN from insulting Islam. And Hillary Clinton's response was, well, we can't do that because we have something in America called the First Amendment. But she said, we're working on ways to get around that. And you think, working on ways to get around that? Well, the strategy is, yes, you have freedom to say whatever you want in America, but if you yell fire in a theater and people get killed, you're held liable. So the strategy is, let's let somebody insult Islam and then have a big crisis and then blame it on that person. And then the day after the Benghazi event happened, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and I don't know what he's doing still being involved in things, but he sends out a message that filmmaker should be not only held liable for the ambassador's death, but should be tried for treason and conspiracy. So now we begin to see this was their agenda behind it. They wanted to make anybody that insulted Islam be held liable for treason and conspiracy. This is their way of instituting this agenda. And
it's
just by a miracle that the ambassador's diary was found in the ruins there in Benghazi. And the news reporter said, here, gee, he's asking for support, defense, time and time again. It keeps getting turned down.
So really, this is an attack on freedom of speech.
Right, and you have to understand, in Islam, the sign that you have surrendered is when you agree not to insult Islam. That's the surrender. There is no other surrender. When Muslims, we got 1,400 years of history, and I've written a book called What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, History of Islam in the United States. I've done two DVDs on Islam. One is called Islamic Conquest, Past and Present, and another is called Political Islam's War on the West. And if anyone's interested, my website is AmericanMinute.com. But Islam conquers huge areas, and the first thing they do when they conquer is they forbid any insult of Islam, of their religion. So we have Egypt. Egypt had been Christian for six centuries. Coptic Christian, evangelized by Mark, that wrote the Gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And when the Muslims, 10 years after Muhammad's death, invaded Egypt, they proceeded to cut out the tongues of anybody caught speaking the Coptic Egyptian language. They had to smuggle the bones of Mark out of Egypt by packing them under pork. And the Muslims decided that not just was their religion superior, but their culture was. And so they tore down all the temples and the pyramids and robbed the graves. They actually had one caliph had a whole part of his administration that was to rob graves, Pharaoh's graves. And they wanted to eradicate, sort of like they blew up those Buddha statues in the mountainside of Afghanistan. And then just a year or so ago when they rioted in Cairo, they broke into the Museum of Antiquities and destroyed mummies. And there are imams now that are wanting to destroy the pyramids. And anyway, so then we look at Jerusalem. Jerusalem had been a Byzantine Christian city for three centuries, since Constantine. And then we look at Syria. Syria was the first country to completely be Christian, evangelized by Paul. In Antioch, Syria, is where Christians were first called Christian. The name Christian was invented in Syria. And then Caliph Umar invades and conquers. And then there used to be 250 Catholic dioceses along North Africa. So today, everything that is Morocco, Algiers, Tunisia, and Libya, that used to be Christian. And then the Muslims invaded Spain in the year 711. And in 10 years conquered all of Spain, and then they crossed the Pyrenees, and they conquered southern France, and they were finally stopped just outside of Paris in 732 A.D. by Charles Martel, exactly 100 years after the death of Muhammad in 632 A.D. They went from Arabia to Paris in 100 years. Now, when they conquered, you had three options. One, convert and become a Muslim. Two, die. Three, be a dhimmi. A dhimmi is a second-class citizen, where you can't insult Islam. You can't have a meeting without a Muslim being present to make sure you're not insulting Islam. You can't own a weapon. You can't own a horse. You can't have all these different freedoms. You can't, if your church gets destroyed, you cannot rebuild it. And then you have to pay the jizya. You have to pay an annual ransom of your life. And this is called the dhimmi status. If you or I were to go to Saudi Arabia or Pakistan or Afghanistan today, we would be dhimmi. And our word against the Muslims would not stand in a court. We cannot even, in Pakistan, a Christian cannot even go to court. He has to hire a Muslim to represent him because he has no rights in court. It's the dhimmi status. So one of the first aspects of dhimmitude is you can't insult Islam. And so
The $64,000 question here is why is our president setting us up to be in a position where we are losing our freedom of speech and we are becoming subversive to, or subordinate to Islam?
Well, see, from one point of view, it makes no sense. But from the other point of view, he's enacting an agenda. And this agenda is basically to surrender the entire Middle East to the Muslim Brotherhood. Little history.
Treason.
We talk about it.
Treason. Yes?
Well, yeah, to put it bluntly. Within 100 years of Muhammad's death, Muslims conquered from Arabia to Paris. It was the first Arab Spring. Then there was a Turkish Spring. And the Turkish Muslims conquered all the Persian and Arab Muslims, and then they invaded into the Byzantine Empire, which is today Turkey. Then they invaded into Eastern Europe and surrounded Vienna twice, and invaded Serbia and Hungary and Poland and Wallachia, Moldova. And then they controlled the entire Mediterranean for hundreds of years. And that was the Turkish Spring, right? But after World War I, the Ottoman Empire was destroyed. It was dismantled. And the France took a part of the old Ottoman Empire, Lebanon and Syria. Britain took a part of the old Ottoman Empire, Palestine, Iraq, and they gave birth to Israel out of that. They wanted America to take a part of the old Ottoman Empire, Armenia. We said no, and unfortunately, 1.5 million Armenians were killed between 1915 and 1922. But the Ottoman Empire was, for all practical purposes, gone. And you have to understand, the British Empire for 200 years was the most powerful empire on planet Earth. And then America comes along, World War I, and then World War II. So we had, the West is developing airplanes, telephones, televisions, you know, all kinds of advancements. In Arabia, they're still riding around on camels. And so this Muslim world decides that the future is being like the West. And so they get rid of their fundamentalist cousins and they put in secular dictators. And these secular dictators dress in business suits and they speak English in their countries and they send their kids to the West to go to school. You look at a 1950s Egyptian high school yearbook and the kid looked exactly like the Americans. You got the Shah of Iran. I mean, he loved America. I went to school and college with an Iranian student. He had an American flag on his dorm room wall and a picture of the president. I mean, I didn't even have a picture of the president or an American flag when I went to college, you know. I mean, they loved America. And so the Muslim world began to move in this nice Western direction until two things happened. One, the Muslim Brotherhood was started in 1928. And their leadership said, stop trying to be like the West. We got to be back to conquering the world for Allah. But they really didn't get much traction until 1938, oil was discovered in Saudi Arabia. And the West began to finance this spread of the violent version of Islam. And 9 out of 10 mosques in America are financed by Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the number one publisher of Islamic textbooks that teaches, you know, where to cut off the hand of a thief and so forth. And then I mentioned Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. But he was from Russia, and he understood the Soviet Union, and he said, well, gee, the way to get rid of the Soviet Union is to let Iran fall into the hands of these fundamentalist Muslims, and it will be a thorn in the side of the Soviet Union and help bring it down. And so our policy as America was to pull the rug out from underneath this secular dictator, the Shah of Iran, and let it fall into the hands of these fundamentalist Muslims. But it's been increasing to where our foreign policy as America has been to pull the rug out from every dictator in the Middle East. And you say, well, they're dictators. Yeah, there's never been a democracy in a Muslim country. Why? Because they have no concept of equality. Allah loves the Muslim, Allah hates the infidel. You know, it takes two women to testify against one man. There's never been a democracy, except in Turkey for a while, and that's just because Ataturk put the military in charge of making sure they didn't get fundamentalists. This new president arrested all the military leaders, locked them away, and now Turkey is going fundamentalist. And we see that right now, our president calling Mubarak in Egypt, saying, step down, let's have democracy. But democracy in a Muslim country always gets taken over by what I call the Black Panther Muslim Brotherhood, and they institute Sharia law. And then we're pulling the rug out from all these different countries to get rid of their secular dictators. Why? Because our policy has been now to turn it all over to the Muslim Brotherhood. Their goal is to reestablish the Ottoman Empire, one homogeneous Muslim entity that's powerful, and then take the next step of conquering the world, you know. And that's their agenda, and our foreign policy agenda happens to be fitting in with that. Michelle Bachmann, who I know, she's a friend of mine, Louis Gohmert, a congressman, and Trent Frank, they have evidence that Hillary Clinton's assistant Huma Abedin has connections with the Muslim Brotherhood. And here Hillary Clinton's our Secretary of State. So here our whole Secretary of State policy has somebody with the Muslim Brotherhood that's either helping it or guiding it or somehow or other. And anyway, so the Benghazi situation, from one point of view, it looks like somebody is really inept. From another point of view, we see that there's an enacting of an agenda. And, you know, we people have agendas and parties have agendas, and, you know, and it just so happens that our president has an agenda and he's been very diligent in working it.
Wow, my head is going to explode. And it all fits. I mean, and it all lines up with history. It's all right there. Oh, my gosh.
But if anybody's, you know, I've talked about a couple books. One is called Changed Chains. I'll say that slower. It's Change to Chains. And it's the 6,000-year quest for global control. I also have that as an 8-part DVD and then as a book. And then the book on Islam called What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran. And then a DVD, Islamic Conquest. And then another DVD called Political Islam's War on the West. But AmericanMinute.com is my website.
Very good. Thank you, Bill Federer, for being with us tonight. That was just incredibly enlightening and very informative, and my head is going to explode. It just all falls into place so conveniently. We really appreciate you being with us tonight and
well,
putting
I will
that
end
all
with
into perspective.
This one thought,
yes.
That it's, you know, I come back to the spiritual looking at it, and that it's in times of crisis power concentrates, but it's also in times of crisis that people turn to Christ. And I can't help but think that through all of what's happening, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to realize that there's more to watching, you know, than watching your nightly sitcom on TV. That they're going to start seeking the Lord, and you know, hopefully we'll have a spiritual revival that'll be sort of like the Great Awakening and help keep the satellite in orbit another generation.
Yeah, one can only hope before it's not too late. All right. Thank you, Bill Federer. Thanks. We hope you'll come back again very soon.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks. Have a great evening.
All right.
We hope you enjoyed that interview with Bill Federer, and it is my plan to ask him back on the show as often as possible, as often as he's willing to come back on. He's just an amazing man, and you can't get enough of the information that he's got stored in his head. It's just wonderful and valuable information for folks when they're looking at trying to process the goings-on in the Middle East and all across the world. Our next guest is Bill Phelps. We were fortunate enough to have Bill Phelps, the director of Missouri Fair Tax, on with us earlier this summer. I know fair tax is a very hot-button issue with a lot of folks across the country. A lot of folks in Missouri, especially in the Patriot Movement, are looking very hard at the fair tax issue. It's complicated, and it's one that I don't know a whole lot about, but as I learn about it, I'm really starting to warm up to the idea. And Bill Phelps did a great job last summer of giving us the basic education about what fair tax is and what it can do for you. And let's take a listen to that interview right now. Let's get started tonight. As I said a few minutes ago, we are fortunate enough tonight to have the Missouri coordinator for Fair Tax, Bill Phelps, here. We're hoping that he can enlighten us. I know a lot of you are a lot of the grassroots folks really do support the Fair Tax initiative. I am one of those people who've been kind of watching it, trying to learn about it, don't know everything that I probably should know about it, but we have Bill Phelps here tonight to enlighten us. Good evening, Bill. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much. How would you like to have a full paycheck without any deductions for income tax or payroll taxes, Medicare taxes, or any of the other deductions for taxes? That's the fair tax. It eliminates all taxes on income, payroll taxes. You control the amount of tax you pay by what you buy. You would pay a national retail sales tax only on the purchase of new goods and services. There's no business-to-business taxes, so the hidden taxes that are built into the price of everything we buy go away. That's what the fair tax does. You have to look at it as a replacement for the income tax and the payroll taxes that we now pay, as well as the hidden taxes that people don't realize they're paying.
I know that one of the questions that people have about switching over from the progressive tax system that we have now to the fair tax system or a flat tax system is, will the switch be enough to cover the issues that we're paying for now. You know,
yes, definitely. The fair tax does. I don't know about the flat tax. That's an income tax. The flat income tax has all of the same problems as the current income tax. It's just it'd be more like a alternative minimum tax being your only tax.
Right.
But the fair tax is a sales tax only on the purchase of new goods and services. There are no exemptions. There are no tax shelters. There are no special interest tax breaks. And so what you find in the income tax where people utilize tax shelters and so forth, high-income people, to, in effect, lower their tax burden, that doesn't happen under the fair tax. That happens only under an income tax. Now, the fair tax is progressive because the more money you spend, the more taxes you pay. And so we know that as people earn more or have more income, they tend to buy more new goods and services, which would be taxable. So the fair tax is called fair, however, because it's fair to all income groups. All income groups would have a lower effective tax rate compared to their current effective tax rates. And, of course, for the first time, the poor and low-income people would be tax-free at the poverty level. Today, the poor, even the poorest of the poor, pay the hidden taxes.
Right.
Now, I bet you don't know what the hidden taxes are, do you?
Why don't you tell me?
Well, the hidden taxes are the income taxes, the payroll taxes, the compliance costs, of everything that went into the product or service that you're buying. In other words,
are you suggesting that goods and services would be less expensive than without those taxes?
The hidden taxes are the payroll taxes, income taxes, compliance costs of everything that went into the production of that product or service. And they amount to about 20-22% of the price of everything we buy, including the poorest of the poor. They pay these hidden taxes. You see, corporations don't pay taxes. They just collect taxes from consumers. And the taxes that you apply to corporations or in the production of a good and service, that goes into adding on to the price of the product. And so the fair tax eliminates those hidden taxes. It also has a provision called the prebate, which is a refund in advance of the sales tax paid at the poverty level of spending. Now, the poverty level of spending is based on family size. So, for example, a family of four, which is typical married couple with two children, would be in effect tax-free on $28,000 of spending on new goods and services, and there would be no tax on used property under the fair tax, which means that if they spent twice that amount, $56,000, on new goods and services and spent more on used property, their effective tax rate would be 11.5%, even though at the cash register, they'd be charged 23%. What happens with the prebate that makes it a progressive tax, where you're untaxed at the poverty level, makes the fair tax a progressive tax. The more you spend above the poverty level on new goods and services, the more taxes you pay.
Okay, you guys have a wonderful website. I was surfing the website this week, and you have a lot of information there. And you have some information for the federal fair tax and the Missouri fair tax. Is there a difference there? Is there something
Well, there's only one fair tax. That's H.R. 25, S-13, pending in the U.S. House and U.S. Senate. H.R. 25 has 70 co-sponsors, including three House members from Missouri. Representative Todd Akin of St. Louis is a co-sponsor. Sam Graves from North Missouri is a co-sponsor, and Billy Long from Southwest Missouri, the 7th District, is a co-sponsor of H.R. 25. And, of course, we are a grassroots, nonpartisan, a nonprofit organization. I am the Missouri State Director and also, incidentally, former Lieutenant Governor of Missouri. And we are all volunteers for the fair tax because we believe it's the best system for the United States. It was developed with $22 million of private donated funds with some of the leading economists in the United States. And what it would do, it would stimulate our economy. It would bring jobs back to Missouri and back to America that are leaving our shores today because of the income tax. So this is the most important thing we can do for the economy, is to pass the fair tax. And we are a grassroots advocacy group asking people to contact their members of Congress and say, will you support the fair tax? Will you be a co-sponsor of the fair tax?
Okay, excellent. Well, I encourage everybody to go to MissouriFairTax.com. There's all kinds of information there about the details of the fair tax. There's information in there about how you can get involved and
right,
promote
and
the
also,
fair tax.
And also our national website. We are an active organization that's part of the Americans for Fair Taxation, and that is the national website is at fairtax.org, one word, fairtax.org, and I urge you to go there. It has a wealth of information, as you said. You can answer a lot of your questions there. You can actually put in your own income and see how you would benefit from the fair tax compared to what you're currently paying in income and payroll taxes.
Oh, excellent.
And also, we hope that you'll sign up as a supporter of that website, which is fairtax.org, and you'll receive emails about the progress of what we're doing and be asking for your help from time to time.
Thank you very much, Bill Phelps from Missouri Fair Tax. Also, notice they have a tab on there. We just want to thank Bill Phelps for coming on the program last summer. We hope to have him on more again in the future. And as we're about to go over the fiscal cliff and start to feel the pinch of all the Obamacare taxes that are about to take place in 2013, the folks really need to become informed on what alternatives may be available to them as far as the tax restructure. So Bill Phelps is a great resource for that. We hope you'll go to his website and check out all the information that he talked about in the interview. And we are really looking forward to having him on again more as time goes by. Our next interview is with Ken Bohm of the National Legal Policy Center. And a big issue in the 2012 elections was the Claire McCaskill and Todd Eakin debate. And shortly before the election, we had Darren Morley of Reboot Congress on, who gave us some information about Claire McCaskill and her business dealings with her husband, Joe Shepherd, and how they profited from her position in the Senate to the tune of millions and millions of dollars of taxpayers' expense. And Ken Bohm is a forensic genius at being, he found some just incredible information that was never reported in mainstream media. And we were fortunate enough to have an interview with him shortly before the election. So let's take a listen to that interview again. And, you know, we're all dealing with Claire. She was reelected in November, as we all know. And this is really important information for folks to know about what's really going on behind the scenes with your senator, Claire McCaskill.
Today we have with us Ken Bohm from the National Legal and Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Mr. Bohm has done just an amazing amount of research. From what I spoke to him a little bit yesterday, and from what we found out is that there are a lot of underlying corporations and a lot of underlying pathways to finding more of this kind of behavior from the McCaskill Shepherds, and he's here with us today to kind of walk us through that information. Thanks for being with us today, Ken.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
So, you published an article. We broke this last week on Culture Vigilante last week on Wednesday, and you published an article on Thursday with much more detail and much more information on just how Joe Shepherd structures his companies to kind of, I don't want to say hide, but it's almost, he almost hides these corporations in multi-levels of government, and the money that's going through these multiple corporations that he and McCaskill own together is just, it's phenomenal. It's all funded with taxpayer money, yes?
Yes, and the big picture for people who have not been following this sector closely is that Claire McCaskill is one of the wealthiest U.S. senators. Now, as many wealthy U.S. senators, you've got Senator Curry of Massachusetts, people like that. But what makes her wealthy in a different way is her wealth is based on her husband's real estate financing empire, and that is largely based on low-income housing, and the tax credits are available for that. And for folks to say, how can you become wealthy on low-income housing? And the answer is, there's pour billions of dollars a year into various programs to benefit it. And in the past, people who've had a political pull have been able to amass quite a bit of money. And that's really the story behind her fortune, which is worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars, possibly quite a bit more. And I can give you the quick background on it. The quick background is this. People have known for years in Missouri that she has, her husband's thing has been based on, her husband's fortune has been based on taxpayer money. But some new things have come out just in the last month. And one of the new things that came out was that the AP did a story early October. And AP did the story, said something like $40 million in benefits went to these various entities that her husband's company benefited from, her husband's various companies benefited from. And that's a big number, $40 million. Now, her response to that, or her campaign's response, because she was not made available to AP, but her husband's response to that, her campaign's response was, well, that's not what we made. You know, we made a small amount, and these were partnerships and so forth. We found an additional $20 million that went to entities, and all of the $20 million, it's actually over $20 million, came from the stimulus bill. Claire McCaskill supported the stimulus bill. Claire McCaskill had a role in shaping the stimulus bill. She argued for it on the floor of the Senate. She proposed amendments. She, in effect, campaigned for it. And every cent that came out that benefited her family, presumably she knew about in advance. It's hard to imagine somebody with her background as a state auditor
right. Didn't
know that there was going to be $20 million plus benefiting her companies, her husband's companies. And, of course, she's married, and they're jointly owned as a couple, and so this is money that directly benefits her. And she kept that a secret, and it's been essentially a secret since the stimulus bill passed in early 2009, and now in October, by spending hours and hours going through thousands of public records, we were able to show exactly how that money flowed. And and it's scary because it does point to a certain degree of cronyism. I'll give you an example. When the federal government poured this money, something like $30 million to Missouri for low-income housing, they put it into something, or to be administered by something called the Missouri Housing Development Commission. It's a state-based entity that administers a lot of HUD funds and other funds. The executive director of the Missouri Housing Development Commission was during this time when it was getting all this money, was a former business partner of Joseph Shepard. That's Senator McCaskill's husband's name. And what do you know, a good chunk of the money, more than $20 million, of 30-something million, went to entities that were directly financially tied to Joe Shepard. And so if we're following the money, which is the Watergate dictum, 30-something million comes from Washington, stimulus bill. It goes to an entity run by Joe Shepard's former business partner. And then, even though it was very competitive, or that's what we were told in numerous stories around the country, lots of low-income housing folks wanted this money. What do you know, six of the groups that get it are tied to Joe Shepard's companies. Now, how are they tied to him? Shepard has a company called Missouri Tax Credit Fund, LP, Limited Partnership. They get involved in financing. What they did, and this is where it becomes very secretive, they worked through a third-party group which was financing these six entities that were going to benefit from the money. This in-between group was run by people who were associated for many, many years with Joe Shepard as employees. Then he issues them financing. And we know this because we looked up the financing records or something called Uniform Commercial Code. It's where people file financing statements, much the way an individual person who buys a home and gets it mortgaged files a mortgage. And when we sat down and pieced together the trail led right to this Missouri Tax Credit Fund owned by Shepard. And, of course, his wife, Senator McCaskill. Now, we don't know exactly how much they got, but I can tell you that this Missouri Tax Credit Fund is very, very lucrative for Senator McCaskill and her husband. And we know this because every senator has to file an annual financial disclosure report under the Ethics and Government Act, and anybody can get this on the internet. And when we looked at Claire McCaskill's financial disclosure reports, which just go on for page and page after page because of the fortune.
So many companies.
Has.
Yeah.
And when we look at this, we see that this Missouri Tax Credit Fund was only worth $500,000 to $1 million in 2008, but 2009. Once the stimulus passed, it's worth in the highest category, which is simply called over $1 million. And in 2010, it was worth over $1 million. 2011, over $1 million. Even more important than what it was worth is how much income came to Senator McCaskill and her husband. And what she checked there was the same category, over $1 million in 2009, 2010, and 2011. Now,
and that could be, I mean, that could be $5 million. I mean, it could be $1 million and $1. It could be $5 million.
Right.
It could be $10 million. We don't know because they
right.
don't release
because she
that.
She will not disclose her income tax returns. And the reason I think she won't, and some politicians do and some don't, the reason she should, as distinguished from others, is this. They get their money from the federal, all these federal and state programs. And we know from her airplane fiasco last year, where her husband's companies or networks of companies owned the airplane, she was billing the taxpayer, but whoops, some of the money went for flights that were political, which meant that taxpayers were improperly and illegally funding political flights for Senator McCaskill. So she got burned on that, and then it turned out, because of the secretiveness, we didn't know this at the time the story first broke, that this plane should have been paying taxes, local
right.
taxes, because it's, you know, one valuable asset. And that was hundreds of thousands of dollars. So her secretiveness and her husband's interests and financial interests have before been controversial and illegal, and now we're getting into even bigger chunks of money. And by way of comparison, every U.S. senator gets $174,000 a year, which is a decent salary, mm-hmm. and they get other benefits attached to that, and so forth. But compare her $174,000 a year salary as a U.S. senator with the more than $1 million she and her husband make just from this one company, and this company is in the business of financing low-income housing, mm-hmm. and it's pretty easy to finance low-income housing even during a credit freeze and financial downturn when the federal government's supplying all the money.
Well, and we also know that Joe Shepard has been using the position of his wife, I mean, to sell some of the tax credits that he's obtained. There's an audio floating around out there where he's been selling, making deals in the Senate dining room with members. You know, he's got the privilege of eating in the Senate dining room because his wife is a U.S. senator, and he's making
right.
deals there to sell some of his tax credits. And in effect, correct me if I'm wrong here, what we have here is we have a prominent U.S. senator's husband who is benefiting, building a business off the benefit of tax credits, which his wife supported, and taxpayer money, and then he's also benefiting from those people who are living in this low-income housing, this business that he's built, which are probably being paid by taxpayer funds.
You've got that, and then you've got the fact that HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, funneled tens of millions through that Missouri Housing Development Corporation headed by his former business partner. They were supposed to compete them competitively. Hopefully they did. But it seems like at least something of a conflict of interest when his companies benefit from six of the awards worth more than $20 million.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that former business partner that headed up that state commission unexpectedly and abruptly resigned once most of this money had been awarded. So there's questions there. And then there's some things, and Lisa, that we discussed yesterday a little bit that weren't in our article, but I can mention them because they're public record, but they're buried away, and nobody else has dug this out publicly, at least certainly not the mainstream media. But the Inspector General of HUD, Inspector Generals are the folks who are there to protect the taxpayer against waste, fraud, and abuse, audited the Missouri Housing Development Commission's stewardship, their administration of these stimulus funds in low-income housing. And what did they find? They found that more than $3 million was spent either improperly or without proper receipts and information. They found a host of irregularities, and while inspectors general do not list the individual programs, the fact that Shepard and his wife, for that matter, financed six of the groups that got more than $20 million out of 30-something million, you have to believe that some of these abuses uncovered by the Inspector General were in these programs run by these programs that benefited Mr. Shepard. And that's something we're further looking into. Have to say a few words about TradeCrypt. We're very, very careful here.
Right.
We have a former inspector general on our board of directors. I'm a former prosecutor. We have people who we work with on a regular basis who have all sorts of skills in going through voluminous filings. This took quite a bit of time, and when we saw the pattern of the money, stimulus money, to the state program run by his business partner, what do you know, the groups that are financially tied to him are getting massive amounts of that money, and then the inspector general does an audit and finds out that over 10% of the money was being spent in a careless, if not improper or illegal way. That paints a picture.
Absolutely.
And
at the very
least,
the
public's entitled to know what happened with that.
Yeah, at the very least, an investigation is in order.
Yes, and there's lots more. We also found out that another one of Mr. Shepard's companies, he's got quite a few companies, LLCs, limited partnership. In fact, he's got hundreds, and that's just from his wife's financial disclosure report. Another one of his companies benefited because they had financial dealings with five of the six entities that benefited from the stimulus money. So he was getting money in several different ways, benefiting from the stimulus. Now, you'd think that maybe the senator, because she's been outspoken in favor of whistleblowers and transparency and accountability, you think that what she might do would be publicly say, well, my husband's doing this, but I'm going to lay it all out for the taxpayers and let them decide, just to show we have nothing to hide. Well, nothing of the sort.
Right.
As you recall, when the AP came out with their story, her campaign would not make her available to the AP reporter. And that was AP, which is mainstream media, goes without saying that she never put this out for anybody to see until we were able to piece it all together. And I doubt she will. This is the only time she really lays things out on the table is when, in effect, it's already been exposed. I mean, we saw that with the airplane scandal,
sure.
Air Claire, as they call it. And I suspect that this is going to go on, because now that we found out that she has benefited, she and her husband's company have benefited to such a great degree, I think she has to explain what's what. One of the things we're looking at is a complaint to the Inspector General of HUD. He found all these irregularities. There's no sign at all that he knew that the companies benefiting from this did their financing through a series of entities benefiting Senator McCaskill's husband's company. We were very careful in looking through that, and so what we're preparing is a complaint to the Inspector General of HUD saying, you notice this pattern of irregularities, well, here's six of the entities that got over 20 million of the 30-something million. Could you look to see, number one, how they happened to successfully compete for this money, considering the person who made the awards was a former business partner of the senator's husband? And number two, was there a pattern of these abuses where all kinds of expenditures, money's being spent, these are stimulus funds, meaning your funds and my funds, all federal taxpayers' funds, were being spent improperly. Either it was for a purpose that was not allowed, or they made the expenditure, but they didn't have any paperwork to back it up. To anybody who's out there, who's listening, who's a forensic accountant, who deals in the world of accounting, when you start getting millions of dollars, approximately 10% of the money being spent in a way that is either not allowed or cannot be properly documented, that's a scandal. That's a scandal, because normal businesses don't come anywhere near that kind of large figure. And the fact that it's taxpayer money, and the fact that the senator helped direct that money in terms of voting for it, speaking for it, and even shaping the program, just makes it a bigger scandal.
And you're not going to hear about this. There's been one AP article on it that I have been able to find, and you told me that Breitbart picked up your article today, and a few other bloggers have picked it up. We've highlighted it on Missouri Grassroots Coalition. And hopefully this will gain some legs, but I really doubt that before the election that the mainstream media is going to pick it up. But we are going to continue to follow this story, Ken Boehm, and we hope that you'll keep us posted on developments as they arise, because this is there are scandals coming out of the Obama administration left and right, and this is another one of them. And here we have this heated senatorial race between Claire McCaskill and Todd Akin, and we can't get this story out into the media.
Yeah, the public's entitled to know this. This is the public money, and it's not like we're talking about $50 or $100,000 or even $1 million. We're talking about more than $20 million, and we're talking about it being done in a secretive way because the senator never revealed this. And it's a scandal in the making, and it's quite a big scandal. There have been a lot of scandals associated with the stimulus money. It's been sent overseas. It's been misspent. It's been given to these so-called green energy companies that were run by bundlers for the Obama campaign. The stimulus thing, which was a spectacular flop, as we all know. This was the thing that was supposed to bring down unemployment, and unemployment went higher. This smacks of cronyism. It smacks of certainly abuse of taxpayer funds, and the fact that the senator is not interested whatsoever in explaining to the public how much money she and her husband made from these six entities speaks for itself.
Yeah, what a gross abuse of authority. Well, thank you, Ken Baum of the National Legal and Policy Center. If you want to read more about this story or other issues that they're working on, go to nlpc.org, and we will be in touch with you. We do want to follow up on this story because I know that you're working on other issues related to this, and we want some follow-ups on that. So thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate it, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Ken.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
We're back, and this is Lisa Payne Nager with Missouri Grassroots Radio, and this is your Wednesday Night Culture Vigilante Hour. We want to thank Ken Baum for his time and all of the energy that he's put into doing the research on what's going on in Washington, D.C. with Claire McCaskill. We appreciate Bill Phelps and Bill Federer for taking the time with us this past year to talk to us about the issues. And I want to thank all of the great folks at Missouri Grassroots Coalition. They've done a lot of hard work and put a lot of effort into putting this programming together so that we can help to coalesce all of the grassroots folks out there and all of the groups and all of the individuals in the grassroots movement so that we can bring accountability to Missouri and the legislature and all of the folks involved in the political structure. We've done a lot of great things also on the charitable front, and we're going to talk a little bit more as the time goes by about the Secret Santa program. It was wildly successful this year. We had a goal of raising $500, and we doubled that goal. And our goal is to double that again in 2013, but I can tell you, as one of the folks who participated in that program this year, it was just incredibly satisfying to be able to go to the department stores on Christmas Eve and pay off the accounts of those less fortunate and those folks who are struggling to make Christmas for their families. And I know that the other folks in Missouri Grassroots Coalition will be talking about their experiences as well and let you know, but I can tell you from personal experience that the folks in the department stores and the folks that benefited from this program just were very grateful, and I'm sure that on Christmas morning we made a lot of kids happy. So as the year goes by in 2013, our goal, is, like I said, is to double that number so that we can help more families maintain the magic of Christmas for their children, and we'll be talking a little bit more about that as time goes by. But I just wanted to thank you folks again for joining me here on Wednesday night. And remind you, again, our programming will be expanding in 2013. You'll have Dave with the Hour of Truth on Mondays. We'll have the Cynthias on Tuesdays, Cynthia Davis and Cindy McGee from Show Me Patriots, Cindy on at 7 and Cynthia on at 8. And I'll always be here on Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock for you folks with your Culture Vigilante Hour with a variety of guests throughout the coming year. And on Thursday nights, we have Kevin Cronick with Hillbilly Logic, so don't miss that. He has great programming on Thursday nights with wonderful guests as well. And we are trying to expand our programming 7 nights a week, so keep an ear out for the developing issues on that. We'll keep you informed as things gel. And we just want to thank you folks for working with us over the last year. If you have not had an opportunity to go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and sign up to be a member of MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, it doesn't cost you a penny. It doesn't cost you anything. What it does do for you is allow us to communicate with you when issues arise that need your attention. We will be monitoring the legislature very heavily as the session begins. in 2013 to keep you informed on what's going on in Jefferson City on issues that will affect your daily life. And it would be great to have your contact information, so go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and click on the Join tab and give us your information. We would like to make sure that the legislature knows that there are thousands and thousands of patriots who have coalesced together under one group who are sharing information about what's going on and the decisions that they're making for us at the Capitol. And that'll be about wrap it up for us tonight on this night after Christmas. I want to wish everybody a very happy new year. We'll be here with you in 2013, and we look forward to talking to you again. Happy new year, folks.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.